Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Special Agent Sheila O'Connor in the second of a two-part interview. Our first conversation focused on her adventures in wildlife law enforcement. This second conversation concentrates on what it takes to be an agent, and in particular, on the specialized wildlife law enforcement training that officers must go through. Have you ever wondered how you get to be a Fish and Wildlife Service special agent? It's an extremely difficult and selective process. In fact, the most recent class of 24 rookies was whittled down from over 800 very qualified applicants. After entering the force, the special agent must complete two types of training. First is criminal investigator training, which all federal agents must take. Then, for wildlife law enforcement, there is an additional 16 weeks of rigorous, specialized training focused on the special circumstances of wildlife law enforcement, called Special Agent Basics. Special Agent O'Connor is a veteran wildlife law enforcement officer with 20 years of service under her belt, who now serves as a training officer at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, also known as FLETC, located in Georgia. FLETC is the interagency law enforcement training organization that serves 88 federal agencies. Special Agent O'Connor began her career in wildlife law enforcement as a conservation police officer for the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, where she served for 8 years. She then moved to federal wildlife law enforcement with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, where she's been a special agent for over 12 years. She was first posted to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and then moved to St. Paul, Minnesota. During that time, she investigated several cases that led to felony convictions for violations of wildlife laws, something we talked about last time. In this, our second conversation, Special Agent O'Connor takes us through the intensive training federal wildlife law enforcement officers must go through, called Special Agent Basics. When we spoke, I began by asking Special Agent O'Connor why we need federal wildlife law enforcement.
Well, the world is now global. Things that were out of poacher's reach before, those countries are now open through air travel, through increased road building and logging. Just to give you an example, CITES, the international treaty, now protects more than 30,000 different animal and plant species. 30,000. That's an increase of something like 75% since the 1990s when the United States first became a signatory of that treaty. There are three main causes of extinction of wildlife. One is illegal poaching, the illegal hunting and killing of animals, or the illegal collection of plants, the illegal killing of plants. Habitat destruction is the other big one. Things lost, land lost to development. And the third is pollution. We can control all three of those. The only thing we can't control is, you know, things that made the dinosaurs become extinct. But law enforcement plays a role in all of those. Of course, we play a significant role, I hope a significant role, in controlling poaching and stopping poaching. We also have a crossover into pollution investigations, you know, contaminants and stuff that kill wildlife. We have the ability to penalize people who do that. And so the need is we have wildlife that's disappearing at a rate of approximately one species per day goes extinct somewhere in the globe in the United States. One species per day. And most of the major reasons that plants and animals become extinct are within our control. So that's why we need fish and wildlife agents and counterparts across the globe, for that matter, people who are dedicated to protecting natural resources wherever they occur from illegal activity.
So now you're an instructor at FLETC, and I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about the training process. You know,
sure.
How do you get to be a special agent?
You know, well,
what type of training is required?
We just hired a class, so I can tell you a little bit about that process. All of our jobs, the process starts with the job announcement itself. All of our jobs are announced on a website, usajobs.gov. All federal jobs for all federal agencies are listed on that website. So anyone who is interested in a job in federal law enforcement can go to usajobs.gov and they can set up an account, put up a resume, and then they can get notified when certain positions become available. So we announced last October that we were going to hire a class of 24. The applications came in. They were scored. We interviewed the top 100 candidates, just, you know, based strictly on their applications. For us and for most federal law enforcement agencies, there are essay questions that people have to answer. And so that's where the scores come in, is how well did you answer, how thoroughly did you answer the knowledge, skills, and abilities questions. So, and we have a predetermined number. You know, we were hiring 24. We interviewed the top 100 applicants based on their scores. And then from there, there are progressive stages. If you make it past the next stage, then you continue to be in the process and that sort of thing. And we whittle it down to 24. We don't hire people who don't have previous experience. They just don't do well enough during the hiring process. For example, someone who's just graduated college who wants to become a special agent with the Fish and Wildlife Service is going to have to go and get experience for a few years somewhere else.
Experience with wildlife or experience with law enforcement?
With both, with wildlife law enforcement. And I can tell you, in this class that we most recently hired, it's made up mainly of refuge officers and wildlife inspectors, both of whom already work for the Fish and Wildlife Service. Refuge officers are uniformed officers who patrol our properties, our national wildlife refuges, and they make cases. They'll go out and they'll check duck hunters, and they'll handle complaints of illegal commercialization and, you know, marijuana grows, and they'll run radar, and they'll check boats, and they do the whole gamut of wildlife law enforcement on our properties. Wildlife inspectors are stationed at ports of entry and international airports all across the United States, and they inspect shipments that are entering and leaving the United States to see if they contain illegal wildlife. And both of those groups tend to do very well in the hiring process, because a lot of the questions that are asked are, describe your experience in enforcing federal wildlife laws. Well, they do it every day. That's not to say that we don't hire anybody else, because we do. We hire agents who have experience with other federal agencies, including places like the Park Service, the Forest Service. We even get people from the Secret Service and FBI every once in a while, ATF. I think we've hired a couple of air marshals in the past. So the most important thing is that you get experience enforcing federal wildlife laws. EPA is another place where we have crossover duties. So if you were able to hire on with EPA, for example, you would get some good experience in enforcing wildlife laws because of the whole contaminants issues. EPA is Environmental Protection Agency. So once you get hired, then we have to determine if you need, you have two classes that you have to take before you can go out into the field. One is the Criminal Investigator Training Program, and that's for all federal agents, no matter what agency you're working for, in order to be certified as a federal, the equivalent of a federal peace officer, is you need to have this Criminal Investigator Training Program. Wildlife inspectors and refuge officers do not have that, so they have to go through Criminal Investigator Training Program. After that is finished, but agents from other agencies like Secret Service, they've already been through that course, so they don't have to take it again.
So what is involved in that criminal investigator training, and who does that training?
The training is put on by the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. That's FLETC. That's down here in Glencoe, Georgia. It consists of, they learn basic federal law enforcement skills. So they will learn the basic federal statutes that apply to all agencies, things like money laundering, conspiracy, smuggling, making false statements, those sorts of things. Those apply to Secret Service, to Fish and Wildlife, to ATF. They apply to everybody. They'll also learn the rules of criminal procedure, and they'll learn the Constitution, search and seizure. We don't want to violate anyone's civil rights. So they'll get heavy blocks of instruction on arrest procedures, search and seizure, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, those sorts of things that were all protected from government abuses under the Bill of Rights. They will also learn other basic federal law enforcement skills, things like evidence collection, surveillance. They'll get blocks. They will have mandatory fitness training, vehicle training, how to drive vehicles at higher speeds safely. They'll also have a lot of instruction on firearms and other officer safety issues, like how do you take someone, you know, how do you handcuff someone safely for them and safely for you. So those are the kinds of things that are covered in the criminal investigator training program.
Oh, I was going to say, how long does that last, that training?
About 10 weeks. Okay. That training is about 10 weeks. And then right when they graduate from that, the next day, they start Special Agent Basic School, which is our own training program for Fish and Wildlife agents only. And that's where they'll learn about federal wildlife laws, things like the Endangered Species Act and the Migratory Bird Treaty Act that we talked about before. They'll learn about those laws. They'll learn, they'll get blocks of instruction on wildlife identification. Can't enforce the Migratory Bird Treaty Act unless you know what migratory birds look like and which birds are which. Particularly important when it comes to duck hunting. Have limits things like many states will say, okay, you can shoot four mallards, but only one of them can be a hen mallard. Well, our agents need to know the difference between a hen mallard and a drake mallard, and between, you know, a mallard and a pintail and a gadwall. So we teach them that. They will get blocks of instruction on other things, enforcement techniques, things that aren't necessarily laws in and of themselves, but are classes of investigation, like contaminants. We're all aware of the oil spill that's going on right now. Federally protected wildlife might be being killed in a contaminant spill, any contaminant spill, large or small. So we would teach them how to investigate contaminants issues. Other things that are on the block of instruction, history of the Office of Law Enforcement. We want them to know how the need for special agents with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife came to exist. They get blocks of instruction on ethics and integrity, very important. We want them to understand, you know, not just the mechanics of the Constitution, but also the fundamentals of good behavior and good investigative skills. They get blocks of instruction on policy and procedure. They get a little bit more on firearms, how the needs that we have for firearms as opposed to what they would learn in the basic school, the criminal investigator school. They'll get blocks of instruction from our lab on how to package hazardous materials, for example. You can't just package up, you know, dead animal evidence and ship it off. It has to be properly package so that all the handlers from the agent to the lab are protected from things like disease and exposure to bloodborne pathogens. We'll give them blocks of instruction on our in-house systems, like our report writing system, for example. We'll give them one thing that's sort of new for this class that's coming up is they'll have a continuing case investigation. So periodically during the time that they're here, they'll be given bits of information on one investigation that will start the day they arrive and end right before they graduate. And that's designed around the blocks of instruction that they're receiving at the time. So if they're receiving a block of instruction on report writing, part of their continuing case investigation is they'll have a report due. So they'll actually have to submit a report to us.
Oh, interesting.
And that serves two, Yeah, I mean, it serves a couple of purposes. Number one, are they understanding which laws are being violated and how they're being violated? And number two, are they writing good reports? You know, they may end up doing surveillance. They may end up doing controlled deliveries or getting search warrants, planning takedowns. All these things are related to the blocks of instruction that they'll be getting during the week. And then it's sort of one of the ways that we tie it all together for them. Yes, you're learning this in a static classroom setting, but here's how it relates to what you'll be doing when you leave here. It's new. We hope it works.
So this is the first time that will have been done in this setting?
For us, yes. Other federal agencies, I believe, have similar techniques.
So I'd like to talk about some of the things you were just touching on. You had mentioned about the history of the Office of Law Enforcement. And, mm-hmm. you know, how did the need for special agents come to exist?
Mostly in the days of market hunting, there were very few laws on the books that protected wildlife from overharvest. And back in the day, those laws were largely controlled by states. Well, in the case of ducks, for example, take just the Mississippi Flyway. How many states are there that can set their own rules on ducks? Well, not necessarily taking into account the health of the overall population that goes through that flyway. And so there'd be a lot of laws that, number one, weren't enforced. Number two, didn't make sense for the continued health of waterfowl. And so waterfowl numbers started to really plummet. At the same time, railroad travel was becoming much more common. And so there were issues with wildlife being illegally taken in, let's say, ducks illegally taken in southern states like Louisiana and Alabama and Arkansas, and then being transported to market areas such as Chicago for sale. So they'd be poached in one state and then transported to another state. And once they leave state lines, the state authorities had no possibility to go after them for the crimes they committed. So there became a need to have some kind of federal oversight. And that's how the need for special agents with the Fish and Wildlife, what evolved into the Fish and Wildlife Service, came about. We've gone through several departmental name changes and combinations over the years.
How did that change also with the Endangered Species Act in the 70s?
Well, there was some regulation of endangered species prior to the Endangered Species Act, but of course that formalized it all and made it a United States law. And so there was a need for more agents, because we obviously just had a lot more work to do. Now, prior to the Endangered Species Act, the main focus of Fish and Wildlife agents was protecting wildlife in the United States. With the Endangered Species Act, that expanded to species all over the globe, all over the world. So there were more agents needed. They had to learn new skills. They had to learn new identification methods. They had to learn about new wildlife that I'm sure some of them had never even heard of before, just like I'd never heard of Duke Langurs and Sparrow before the smuggling case that we talked about earlier came along. I had no idea what those animals were. So we had agents, we had all these new laws and all these new species to protect. And so the service had to adapt and change its mission to include wildlife all over the world.
You had mentioned that some of the skills were a little different for a wildlife law enforcement agent. You had mentioned, say, firearms training or some other issues. So I'm wondering, say, just taking the case of firearms, how is that different for a wildlife law enforcement person versus, say, someone from DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration?
It actually may not be all that different from someone who works for ATF. Firearms are their bailiwick. But the criminal investigator training program only covers handguns, number one. We issue our agents handguns, rifles and shotguns, because we don't know what kind of cases they're going to be up against. Is it going to be a hunting case? You can hunt some species with rifles in some states, and other states require shotguns. So we need to have our agents be proficient with all three types of firearms, because if they're out enforcing those laws, they need to know, number one, what they're looking at. They need to know how to operate it safely. How do you load and unload these things? Part of the migratory bird regulations involve actually checking what kind of ammunition a hunter is using. They can't use lead shot anymore to hunt ducks, nor can you use lead shot on most of our other federal properties, even if you're deer hunting. You've got to use non-toxic shot for the most part now. So we needed to teach our agents how to know not a steel shot from lead shot. You got to be able to know that. You also have to know how to load and unload these firearms safely. You also have to know, by looking at a gun or by handling it and checking it, whether it's the right gauge. You can't hunt ducks with a .22 rifle. So if someone is out there with a .22 rifle and they've got dead ducks, you need to be able to understand that that's illegal. We're out in rural settings. Some of our agents will do undercover work that involves undercover hunts. We also will variously encounter different situations when we're out on search warrants. When I was talking about the live animal, the husband and wife who were selling the live endangered species, and they had grizzly bears, tigers, lions, cougars on the property. Well, when we went to search that, we wanted agents to specifically carry certain types of firearms for safety in case one of those animals escaped. We wanted to make sure that we had a gun that would kill a bear if necessary, instead of killing an agent or a bystander. So for safety purposes, you sometimes need to have different kinds of firearms available for takedowns and that sort of thing. So those are some of the reasons why we might require different kinds of training than someone who works for Secret Service or someone who works for FBI, where they probably are not spending as much time in rural areas, and they probably are not encountering as many people with firearms as we do.
Given that you're often in rural areas, how does, say, surveillance differ?
Well, depending on where, what type of area you're surveilling. I mean, think of a rural agricultural property. Where are you going to hide? Surveillance is very different. You can't just park your car and pull out your binoculars. So we actually do have blocks of instruction on rural surveillance, because it is different from urban surveillance. The need for, it's much easier to hide in plain view, for example, in an urban area than it is in a rural area. You've got to put more thought. You've got to go and look at the areas that you're going to be surveilling and see where you can conceal yourself, if you can. So they learn all about that when they're down at Special Agent Basic School.
And what about, given that you're often in remote places, like training, you had mentioned with vehicles, does that include airplanes?
We do give them some blocks of instruction on airplanes, yes. Most of our agents coming through are not agent pilots, although we do have some. Their pilot training is obviously separate. They go through the normal steps to become a pilot that anyone else would. But the fact is that many of our agents will be in smaller aircraft while they're at work, scouting for bait or responding to a complaint. The agents in Alaska, for example, routinely patrol by aircraft. So we'll give them a block of instruction on aviation safety that we sincerely hope will increase their odds of survival if something should go wrong, like a plane should crash. We want them to be prepared for, you know, what happens if they crash in water versus if they crash on land. And we hope that we are equipping them with the best tools possible to help them survive if that should happen.
Now, when you were in Special Agent Basics, what did you find the most difficult part of it, the most difficult block?
I think probably the most difficult block was the migratory bird identification block. Back then, you learned all the laws and all the ducks and all the raptors and eagles, and had one test at the end of that. That covered, I mean, we have, right now we have separated that out because it's just really intense. So now we separate it out where they'll have a block of instruction on the laws and be tested on the laws. They'll have a block of instruction on eagle and raptor ID and be tested on that. And then they'll have a block of instruction on migratory bird identification and have a block of instruction on that, have a test on that at the end. So it's not all one great big long test anymore. Believe it or not, we do hire agents who have never duck hunted from time to time. For example, people who come from other federal agencies, they may never have duck hunted. And they may be able to point to two birds and say, okay, that one's a duck and that one's a goose, but it's far more complicated than that. So
how many different species do they have to learn how to identify?
Oh, boy, I don't know. It seemed like 10,000 when I was going through it. And I came in with 8 years as a state conservation officer, and I knew all the ducks in the Mississippi Flyway. But we not only learned the Mississippi Flyway, but we learned the Atlantic and Pacific, and also some of the birds in the Alaskan areas, like the sea ducks and stuff, because they show up at taxidermists all over the country from time to time. So if you're looking at a harlequin, you need to know what that bird is and the area of the country that it likely came from, so that you can make sure that the person was properly licensed and that sort of thing. So yeah, the migratory bird block was definitely the most intense. It required the most studying. There was a lot of prayer involved in that too. please.
You know, and given that you'd been 8 years in the state as a state wildlife enforcement agent, what were some of the differences between your previous training and the federal training?
Well, a lot of it was overlap, fortunately. But I had no experience as a state officer. I had no experience with birds outside the Mississippi Flyway. So I had to learn the other birds and how they differed from those in the Mississippi Flyway. On top of that, as a state officer, I did not have blocks of instruction on eagle and raptor ID, for example. So I had to learn all of the eagles and raptors, and I had to learn the difference between a mature golden eagle and an immature bald eagle, which look exactly the same to the average viewer. To the average person, those two birds look exactly the same. In fact, they're not. And at the time when I went through Special Agent Basic, bald eagles were still threatened. And so they were regulated a little bit differently than golden eagles were. You know, we had to learn the difference between a genuine eagle feather and a fake eagle feather. Fake eagle feathers are not against the law. And so we had to learn to identify, you know, for example, one of the things I learned that has stuck with me since 1998 is that the only raptor with a fully feathered toe are owls. If you come in and someone has the owl or the talons of a bird, if it's fully feathered, you know right off the bat it's an owl. It can't be anything else. Hmm. So those are some of the things that
I
learned.
People often come in with talons?
Yeah, well, they're in the black market trade. All the parts of birds, of eagles and other raptors are in the illegal trade, yes. It's not unusual, that it's not unheard of that you would come across someone who only had talons, who had a single feather or who had hundreds of feathers, who had only the head of a bird, who had the skeletal remains only of a bird.
What are they used for? Is it used traditionally with Native Americans?
Yes, there is some black market trade among Native Americans, but a lot of people want to own an eagle feather headdress, for example. Non-Native Americans want that, too. If you've ever watched some of the programs on PBS that value artifacts, you might from time to time see a feather item. I was watching a couple of weeks ago and saw a bowl, a Native American artifact. It was a bowl made out of songbird feathers. And they gave a value, an insurance value, on the bowl. And I thought, that's wrong. There is no value to that because it can never be traded. It can never be replaced. If it's lost in a fire, that's it. There is no replacement value. They can't get another one. Illegal. It was not, of course, this bowl was hundreds of years old, probably, and, you know, was made by Native Americans and was actually in a museum. But there is no replacement value.
What did you find most useful when you went through the Special Agent Basics?
Good question. Probably the blocks that we had on search and seizure and attorney representation. You can never have enough refresher training on protecting people's civil rights. But also it helped me to understand, as a state officer, most of my cases went through petty offense court, and the people just showed up to plead guilty or not guilty for fishing without a license, and they didn't have an attorney with them. But there are legal protections that are put in the system starting from the point when you're represented by an attorney. So when can I, as an investigator, contact someone who's represented by an attorney, and when can't I? Search and seizure, boy, that's just a big area of law that changes a lot. The Supreme Court recently ruled on Miranda, on invoking your right to silence, and said you have to actually actively invoke it in order to stop the police from questioning you further. So that's a big change. You know, the courts are actually, in the last few years, have actually been making a lot of rulings on search and seizure. Very important to keep up on that stuff. And so I probably found that the most useful in daily special agent life.
Now that you're an instructor, how has the training changed since you went through it?
Well, we've added some classes. We've done away with others. And we've restructured some that we intend to keep. I was telling you about the Migratory Bird Treaty Act blocks of instruction. When I went through, that was all one great big long block. Now we've broken it into smaller blocks that make it easier for people who have little or no experience with these laws really learn them and not just, you know, load and dump like you did in college for the upcoming exam. You learn it for the exam and then you forget it. That's not our goal. People have to use these laws when they get out, and we want them to learn them for good, not just for a test.
So what happened?
So that's one of the big changes.
Have there been others?
Sure. We've dropped some classes. We used to have a class, when I went through, we had a class on wetland easements. That really is no longer the bailiwick of special agents. Refuge officers have mostly taken that over, and they're far better at it. So we've dropped that block of instruction. A handful of agents during the course of their career might have cases involving wetland easements, but they can learn that as they go. We don't need to take up class time training everybody to do that when maybe three people out of class will encounter it over the course of their career. So we try and look at that too. We've cut back on the amount of time that agents are with us for the Special Agent Basic School. So we really have to be very judicious.
How long is the course?
It's now 9 weeks. It's been as long as 15 weeks, but this class will go through in 9 weeks. So they'll have 10 of CI, of criminal investigator, followed by 9 of Special Agent Basic.
Have crimes changed over time that's required adding new classes?
Crimes have changed over time. Yeah, the internet was not such a big deal when I first became an agent, and now it's one of the largest conduits in the world for the illegal wildlife trade is these internet auction sites. We have not adapted terribly well. There are some training materials that we've put together, but we're having a very difficult time adapting to the internet trade, because as soon as we adapt, the internet trade changes. So it feels like we're constantly one step behind. But those are some of the issues that we are trying to address through training. If we can give agents some basic skills And, you know, when I had my first internet investigation case, I had never used an internet auction site. Never. I mean, I hadn't in my personal life or my professional life. The most I'd done, the most complicated thing I had done with a computer was email. So I had to learn from scratch. And once I learned how to do it, I found them to be very easy and very rewarding. And, you know, among the easier cases of my investigations, frankly, because everything is right there on the website that you need to convict a person. So I enjoyed those internet investigations, and I found them easier to do than some of the others. And they are these internet auction sites. They're international. The transactions can be completed in a matter of hours versus the same, you know, if you wanted a tiger skin rug to hang on your wall, it might have taken you 4 months to arrange to buy it illegally and get it into the country. Now it might take you 4 hours.
Wow. So could you tell me about one of the internet cases that you might have had?
Sure. When I first transferred to St. Paul, I got a call from one of the agents in New York, and she said, hey, I've been on this internet auction site dealing with a guy to buy a tiger rug that in the ad he says was imported from India, and we're at the final stages where we're going to make a deal. Do you want to take over the case and call this guy and pretend to be me and then go get it and, you know, make the arrest? And I said, well, yes, I do, as a matter of fact. And, you know, there has to be an interstate nexus. So the seller was located in Minnesota. So I pretended to be an interior decorator from New York who was buying the rug for a client. And I made a couple of undercover calls, which I recorded. And I asked the guy, I said, well, geez, how do you think I'm going to get it back to New York without being detected and without getting caught? And, you know, he explained the laws to me. I have this on tape. We agree on a price. And we set a time for the meeting and the exchange where I will pay for this and he will give me the tiger rug. And the day before, I got a search warrant, put together a little team to go in and search the home for, he had said might have some other wildlife items that he'd be willing to sell. And the day before we went in to make the buy and serve the search warrant, I got a call from an agent in Texas, and he said, Sheila, how'd you like to be my sister? And I'm like, this requires an explanation. And he actually had been trying to buy the same tiger rug from the same seller. And we learned that this person had been kicked off. They had advertised the tiger rug for sale on one internet auction site. That auction site found the ad, knew it was illegal, and kicked them off. So bravo for them. He turned around and just put it on a different auction site. And there were tons of, just, you know, without even using a warrant, just by knowing how to use the website properly, I found all these messages that were sent to the seller saying, hey, this is illegal. You can't do this. Tigers are endangered. So one of the elements that we have to prove many times for our offenses, especially if we want to charge them at the felony level, is we have to prove that a person knew he was doing something wrong. We don't have to show that this person knew that tigers are endangered and they've been endangered since 1970, whatever. And, you know, we had to prove that he knew it was a tiger and that it was in some way illegal to sell. And we had all this fantastic evidence because he advertised it on a website where I was able to just, you know, legally go in and read messages that had been sent to him. So that was kind of funny. I found out later when we did the interview, the takedown and interviewed the subject, that there were only two people left bidding on the tiger skin rug, and it was two federal agents. So.
And did
crime doesn't pay.
And did you guys go in together as brother and sister?
No, I had explained to the Texas agent that we had a warrant already and we were going in. And I went in with my boss at the time, and my boss pretended to be my brother-in-law. So we went in and we told the guy, you know, yeah, we've got the check, and wow, this is just a great rug. And, well, you had mentioned that you had some other things that you might be willing to sell. I might be interested in those, depending on what they are. I have a lot of clients who want, you know, they're always looking for unique things to display in their homes, and turned out he didn't really have anything else. But
and then the buyers, is there a way, or is it possible to prosecute buyers of things like that?
Yes, yes. Again, we try and make a distinction between buyers who knew they were doing something wrong versus buyers who didn't. So, for example, if we go back to Elvira the tarantula, any person walking in off the street who wanted to buy Elvira would have seen that sign saying, you know, first one out of Mexico in 3 years, prohibited by Mexican government. We could prosecute that person because clearly they would have knowledge or should have knowledge that they were doing something wrong. But if you walk into the same pet store to buy, what's a reptile that's commonly available, a painted turtle, they may not know that that turtle is likely to be illegal. So what we try and do with the buyers is we do try and determine if they knew or should have known that what they were doing was illegal versus those who just stumbled into a pet shop and said, hey, I think I'll buy a pet turtle today.
After the special agent basics, what happens? Where do the agents go? They start their job right then?
They will graduate. Just so happens that this year they're graduating right before Christmas. So most of them will probably take time off to be with their families. They've been separated from them for 19 weeks. And most of the new agents will report to their duty stations all across the United States on the first workday after January 1. And they will then enter the field training program where they work with a veteran officer for a year. And it starts out where the new agent is doing nothing. They're doing 100% observing the veteran agent do their job. And over the course of the year, that reverses itself to where the new agent is doing 100% of the work and the veteran agent is doing 100% of the observation. And during that year, the new agents will learn from as many veteran agents as possible, different methods for doing interviews, different methods for doing surveillance, different investigative techniques. Some agents are really good at internet investigations. Some agents are really good at undercover hunts. Some agents are really good at import-export. So we try and get the new agents working with as many different veteran agents as possible. And the more they learn, the more a new agent learns, the more of the workload they're taking on themselves until they are at the opposite end of where they started, where they're doing 100% of the work and the veteran agents are doing 100% of the observation, watching them, making sure that they've learned what they're supposed to learn. It's a very complicated job. You can't just graduate an academy and be 100% prepared to do the job the correct way 100% of the time.
So a new field agent will rotate among veteran agents in the same duty station?
Yeah, whenever possible. Yes, whenever possible. You know, some agents, some stations only have one agent. So there's not much rotation that can occur. But we do try and send the new agents on details. For example, when I first came on with Fish and Wildlife, I graduated in September. Of course, that's right at the beginning of most major waterfowl seasons. And a month after graduation, I was in Maryland and Delaware on a waterfowl detail. One of the agents out there had several areas that were believed to be baited, several areas where there were notorious poachers that were supposed to show up at these places. So more than half of my class of new agents, we found ourselves in Maryland and Delaware a month later on this detail, learning, you know, how different agents enforce the same laws and what, and we also worked with state officers too, for that matter. So we do try to get new agents as much experience as possible. There's almost never only one way to do a successful investigation. So our goal is to match the new agent with as many different field training officers as possible.
And then
sometimes it's only one.
And then what about after you are an agent? Do you continue to get training?
Yeah. Federal law requires that all criminal investigators, special agents, that's our title, have 40 hours of continuing education every year. Our agency chooses to handle that with an annual in-service, where it's a national event. We happen to do ours at our training center. The Fish and Wildlife Service has our own training center in West Virginia, and we go there every year, and my division puts on training for veteran agents, for all agents, on a variety of subjects. It can be firearms, it can be defensive tactics, it can be search and seizure. It's always, every year, it includes legal updates, because just because there are so many different rulings that come out of the Supreme Court every year. I'm trying to think what else we had this past. We have an agent stationed in Thailand. We have a position now where we have an agent in Thailand whose job is to provide training to any of our counterparts in any of the Southeast Asian countries that wish it, also to facilitate investigations that have a nexus with the United States. There's about a year ago, I guess, the agent in Thailand helped facilitate a huge ivory smuggling case where the ivory was coming into Los Angeles. So we got a presentation at this past in-service on the smuggling methods that were used and how it was detected and the lab was able to help with, and how the agent in Thailand helped with facilitating the investigation. It's very interesting, actually.
Huh.
So, yes, we will have 40 hours every year of continuing education. That's in addition to what agents might pick up in their own duty stations along the way, interview and interrogation training, for example, additional firearms training. We have to qualify with our firearms twice a year. That is done on a regional basis, not on a national basis. So we also seek comments from agents. What training do you want to see at next year's in-service? So we try and incorporate that as much as possible.
What happens when an agent flubs up? I guess, Heather... to close
we
out
never
our
do,
conversation.
Laurel. We never screw up. We are perfect. We're very special.
Well, you are special. That's why you're called special agents.
That's what the federal government says we're special. Happens when an agent screws up?
Or I guess what I'm really interested in is, can you tell me any stories about where you or somebody screwed up and how you rectify the situation?
No, never. let me think. We occasionally have an agent who will fail to qualify with their firearm, for example. So they'll go through some remedial training aimed at bringing them back up to speed. You know, for whatever reason, maybe they've had an injury in the last year that they haven't been able to practice with their firearm. It happened to me one time. It turns out I needed glasses. I failed to qualify because I couldn't see the target. I needed glasses, and I didn't know it until I showed up and had to really use my eyes to shoot at a target. I wasn't able to do so. Prior to that, I wasn't really aware that I needed glasses. So things like that. So if you fail to qualify, you would go through remedial training. If you had any sort of major mistake in an area of policy and that sort of thing, our goal would be to determine, number one, if it was intentional or accidental. And if it's intentional, you're on your own, you're subject to termination. If it's accidental, our goal is to train you in an area where you didn't have enough training or didn't understand the training that was provided and get you back out into the field. But really, seriously, we have very few lawsuits against our agents. Our agents are very well trained. I just got down here, so I'm not taking credit for that. We have, you know, this last class that was hired, we had 24 openings. We had 800 applications. We can take our pick of the cream of the crop, and we really have some outstanding agents. They're very conscientious. We don't want to violate people's civil rights. We don't need to violate people's civil rights to do our job. And that's one of the areas that we concentrate on with our training. And I'm not aware of a case where we've been successfully sued for a violation of anyone's civil rights. We've had lawsuits filed against some of our agents from time to time, very low numbers, but our agents have always been successful in winning those lawsuits, to my knowledge.
Do you also train foreign wildlife law enforcement agents? You had mentioned this agent in Thailand whose job it is to help with training there.
Right. We do other countries. It's actually through the State Department. The State Department will get requests from foreign governments for various training needs, and the State Department handles all sorts of training requests from foreign governments. We have a group, for example, going to Botswana this September to help train counterparts over there, and this is, I believe, the fourth trip over there where we start off with basic skills and we build and build and build upon what they've learned. And we've done actually several countries in the African continent, and we like to think that we're helping to train our counterparts in foreign countries better at both detecting illegal poaching, let's say, of elephants or, you know, gorillas for the bushmeat trade or the live animal trade or whatever, but also that we're providing them with better skills to bring those cases to court and actually punish the offenders. We like to think that we're helping them with that so that global resources can receive better protection all over the world, because our goal is to protect wildlife all over the world. So we've been to other countries. We've been to Brazil. We've been to Russia, the Philippines. I believe there was a trip that went to Malaysia. Those are the big ones that I can think of off the top of my head. But really, any government that requests assistance through the State Department, we would put together a training program for them.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
Sure. I appreciate your interest in our agency.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about wildlife law enforcement training with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Special Agent Sheila O'Connor. Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.